there, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical news, science, healthcare dialogues, intense discussions, I hope, and answers to your emails and your calls. I'll give out the numbers in just a moment, but before I do that, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, not necessarily this station or its staff or, in fact, even its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It is not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. Well, that being said, I want to welcome you all to Ask Dr. Dawn, and I have a really interesting story that is a well-designed, you could call it a placebo study, showing that Tai Chi actually has a very positive effect on fibromyalgia. So here's the setup. The study was done out of Tufts University. It was single-blinded. In other words, the people doing the scoring did not know. It was a validated instrument assessing fibromyalgia. Now, obviously, the people themselves knew what their experience had been, so it's called single-blind rather than double-blind. 66 fibromyalgia patients participated twice weekly for 12 weeks in either a one-hour Tai Chi session with daily home exercises encouraged or one-hour educational sessions that focused on coping strategies, diet, nutrition, and exercise. Using this validated instrument, at the end of 12 weeks, the Tai Chi group had clinically and statistically significant improvements from baseline. The benefits persisted at 12 weeks with no adverse effects identified, and the improvements were superior to those reported with pharmacotherapies, and that would include the current and highly promoted Savella for fibromyalgia. Their numbers are not as good as these Tai Chi numbers. The study was relatively small, and it lasted for only 24 weeks, so it is not definitive, but I think it's quite promising. So for those of you out there with fibromyalgia, consider Tai Chi as a first step in moving in a healthier direction. This study came out, according to the CDC, one in six Americans becomes sick with a foodborne illness each year. This is billions and billions of healthcare costs. The top illness of the known pathogens was norovirus or Norwalk virus. That's the cruise ship virus that is extremely contagious. It's said that if you're even in the room with someone who has that virus and they vomit, you're probably going to pick it up. It's extremely difficult to clean virus as evinced by those cruise ship epidemics. And no matter how hard they tried to decontaminate, they'd get another epidemic the next time they went out. That's 58% of the known pathogens. Following it was salmonella, which was at 11% and the leading cause of hospitalization. After that, Clostridium, Campylobacter, and Staph aureus, the only toxin food illness in the top 10. Of course, 80% of all foodborne illnesses are unknown, unspecified agents, meaning we never do figure it out. 48 million people a year, however, is a significant number. And if you should happen to be one of those people who gets a foodborne illness, even if you're not a child, I generally recommend using oral rehydration or electrolyte solutions. And no, we're not talking Gatorade. We're talking about solutions that are designed to actually get the right ratio of sodium to glucose to allow a special ATP-dependent pump in your stomach to just suck that water in. And if you get the balance right between the glucose and the sodium, that happens very quickly, almost as fast as an IV. This discovery, oral rehydration, has been around since the early 1970s, and it has saved literally millions of lives worldwide. However, in our culture, people often either don't know about it or only think of it as something for children. This study looked at a sort of Pepsi challenge for oral rehydration solutions, and this was interesting because we often do suggest patients that they go out and get this for themselves or their kids. This study used 66 children, not all named Mikey, but they could have been, aged 5 to 10, without any symptoms. They were given 1 to 6 tasting solutions of 3 different fruit-flavored oral rehydration solutions. They were told you can drink as much as you want for 15 minutes, and then they gave them a visual analog scale, like a horizontal line with a real smiley face, good at one end, and a yuck face at the other end, and asked them to put an X where they thought the best flavor was. Well, the kids complied, and the scores are out. The mean taste scores were 65 for Pedialyte, 58 for Pediatric Electrolyte, and 23 for Infalyte. Sorry about that, Infalyte. So just to give you some suggestions, discerning children prefer Pedialyte. And this is not sponsored by the company, but I did think that it was a nice little study to share with you. I want to spend a little time talking about breast cancer. We had a lot about breast cancer and mammograms come through the news this week. Let's start with just talking about mammograms. That Finnish study that showed only a 10% relative reduction in mortality from breast cancer screening was very much talked about in the last few weeks. There had been last year a recommendation by the U.S. Preventative Task Service that women under 50 not receive annual mammograms. And those two things have had their effect. The rate of mammograms in women under 50 has dropped quite a lot between 2006 and 2009. So is that a good or a bad thing? It would seem to be actually a bad thing. And I'm going to just frame it the following way. If you're a woman under 50 in your 40s and you have the misfortune to develop breast cancer, that breast cancer is likely to be, on the average, more aggressive than breast cancers in women who are older. So your only chance, really, for a long-term cure is to catch that cancer early, which means mammography, because by the time you can feel a breast cancer, it's probably too late if it's an aggressive cancer. Now, if you go and drill down on the Finnish study, what you see is that women who had stage 2 breast cancer actually had a significant improvement in mortality in that group, a 29% reduction in mortality compared to the historical counterparts, which was the control group in the study, which was only 7%. Now, that's 22%. That's significant. But that's only a subgroup of the women with cancer. So when you actually run the statistics for the entire group of women, you dilute out that benefit and it becomes invisible. But we don't do medicine on the average. We do medicine for individuals. So I want to come back down in favor of telling people that as near as I can read the data, and admittedly, it's messy and there's the radiation issues and everything else, I still think you're better off with annual mammograms in your 40s. It may not be cost effective for society, but for the individual, I think it's a win. So two other things on breast cancer, this both for therapy and two kind of sad things, really, because two promising therapies on small studies failed to replicate on large studies. The first one is Zomida. This is a drug that's given for osteoporosis. But last year, an Austrian breast and colorectal cancer study was published that suggested that adding zoledronic acid, or Zomida, to standard breast cancer therapy reduced recurrences by 36% in premenopausal women. Well, that was great news, and everybody jumped on the bandwagon. But now, just out, another study, larger and therefore more likely to show a difference, were there truly one there, did not show improved survival in women who were premenopausal. So that's a sad thing for women in that group. It doesn't look like we can show you the benefit that we thought we had. And in a related story, the FDA has begun the process of removing the breast cancer indication from a monoclonal antibody drug called Avastin, which is also approved for colorectal cancer and several other life-threatening types of cancer. The issue with Avastin is, again, a small study back in 2008 suggested that it was helpful in preventing progression of metastatic breast cancer. Unfortunately, in the practice over the last 2 years of using it, there have been several really nasty side effects that have emerged, and the survival rates haven't differentiated. They haven't split in terms of the survival curves, so there isn't a benefit. And there are some unique and rather dastardly side effects of this drug, including brain swelling leading to blindness and the formation of holes in your intestines and internal organs. So we're really talking about a very seriously ugly drug, potentially. And here are our failures so far in our struggle to try and improve our breast cancer statistics. Again, early detection is the best way. And I think we need to not expect drugs to ride to the rescue once the disease has metastasized. We just don't have that technology yet. I'm going to go to an email. This one from John in Dubai, United Arab Emirates. John writes, "Today I'm very much depressed about my situation. Since the incident, I've been mentally disturbed. It has seriously affected my self-confidence and social interaction. I even get thoughts of this while studying. I've had the loss of a testicle. It is then one day that I went through a magazine that a man was born without testicles, was able to have them through some surgery. Doctor, is it possible to have in any way? Yours faithfully." So, John, I want to tell you that yes, indeed, there are restorative surgeries that, particularly if a man has only lost one of his two testicles, can restore him to physical normal appearance, and also functionally, he can have a normal appearance and a normal fertility. So I hope that you will seek help, because it is possible to bring you back to what you will feel is a state of normality. Another email, this one from B in Hollister. "Dear Dr. Motika, I came down with a case of Bell's palsy at the end of June. 5 months later, I still have some numbness and twitching. A month ago, I noticed that strange interactions between facial movements appeared. Does this mean a regression? Does it mean that the mother nerve is still being pinched? Are the muscles developing movements that I will be able to train not to do? It's very discouraging to seem to go back from the plateau I was at for 4 months. I had movement and was doing well, and my eye didn't close when I pressed my lips together, Dr. 8. Now it's doing all of this. Thanks for your reply." Well, dear B, the eye closing is one of the main functions of the seventh cranial nerve that, when it is lost in Bell's palsy, is very difficult, because if the eye doesn't close, it doesn't get cleaned by the natural closing action, and the cornea can be damaged. That's an important problem. So it's as if you have hyperactive closing of the eye whenever you fire other muscles. I believe that over time this will resolve, and while I see how you would see it as a step backwards, I actually don't think it means that you're relapsing. I do believe that it would be good for you to seek the opinion of an acupuncturist. I have had very good results personally treating Bell's palsy with acupuncture. And while it's a little bit far to come all the way from Hollister, I'm sure there are good acupuncturists in your area who could help you with this. And we're going now to Jane in Santa Cruz. Hello, Jane, and welcome to the program.
Hi. I was wondering what your thoughts are about thermography.
Thermography. You mean of the breast?
Yes.
Well, we actually have a program, an interview on thermography in the archives of Ask Dr. Dawn.
Oh.
The doctor's name was Amalu, A-M-A-L-U. He's a thermographer up in Redwood City that I interviewed. But it's a good general discussion of the advantages and disadvantages of thermography. And I guess you could say that thermography is a very, very sensitive but not very specific type of screening procedure. And what that means is that it picks up almost everyone who has breast cancer, but it also picks up a lot of other people who don't have breast cancer. Now, people are arguing and have been arguing for 20 years about whether the people who have a borderline abnormal thermogram are going to go on and develop breast cancer. That's really the issue, is I think we have a lot of false positives with thermography. But with mammography, we have a certain number, 5 to 10% of false negatives, where in fact there is a cancer and we don't see it. So ask yourself what kind of mistake you want to make. Innocent until proven guilty, or guilty until proven innocent? And what is the downside of an innocent until proven guilty mammogram? Well, you miss a breast cancer and it gets to get further along. Or what about a guilty until proven innocent thermogram? Well, you may end up doing unnecessary biopsies and you may still not be able to affect the course of the disease. In general, what I recommend is mammography. And then when you have a ambiguous mammogram where you aren't sure whether or not you should biopsy something, rather than wait, I often order or suggest a thermogram, although they aren't covered by insurance much of the time. They're a great deal cheaper than an MRI. And the thermogram can tell me whether a lump on a mammogram is high risk, lots of blood flow, warm, and therefore more likely to be cancer, or low risk, not much blood flow, and cold, and therefore something I would feel comfortable just waiting and watching.
Okay. What about doing a thermogram, and then if it's negative, you wouldn't do a mammogram, and if it's positive, you could do a mammogram.
Right.
Would going that way work?
Well, if the thermogram is truly negative, like a class 1, and shows very even low levels of differential heat in the breasts, and the breasts are cool, I think that's very reasonable. There is, however, not good data saying that that's an okay thing to do. It makes a lot of sense. I think it's probably true, but I am making that statement from the seat of my pants and not from a good, high-quality epidemiological study looking at outcomes.
But as a human being...
As a scientist, I think that we can probably expect that cancers are going to have increased blood flow. We know that. We know that they create angiogenic factors that lead to the development of new blood vessels. And the whole concept of using thermography is that if you have increased blood flow to an area, that area is at increased risk for breast cancer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a premise. It's probably an over-inclusive premise, and there's probably other reasons for increased blood flow that have nothing to do with an actual cancer. And that's where the false positives come in.
Mm.
But contrarily, I think... the early studies of thermograms in the 1980s showed that breast cancers have abnormal thermograms, and I think it was just about all of the time.
Mm-hmm.
So I think your logic is good. I just have to say that the data is not there to say for sure that that's a recommendation.
Okay.
It makes sense.
Yeah.
I think it's an okay thing to do. If I had a class 1 thermogram and wanted to avoid radiation exposure to the breast, I would probably do that. As it happens, I have a class 3 thermogram. And as do most women who are still producing estrogen. So with a class 3 thermogram, you're basically stuck with getting a mammogram because you do have some uneven heat distribution in the breasts, and those areas need to be watched.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
I hope that helped.
Yes.
All right, bye-bye.
Bye.
We had an off-air question. See, 3 to 4 times a year, I have periods of distorted vision and a temporary loss of memory. Lasts a few hours. I'm in my 70s. He's been having this for 20 years. What could be the cause? Wow. Okay, well, if you've been having it for 20 years and it's occurring at that frequency, the top of the list would be some kind of a migraine-like phenomenon. Migraine equivalent, it might be called, since there's no headache associated with it. People who have vasospasm, a constriction of blood flow in the brain, will have focal neurological abnormalities, such as distorted vision. Sometimes this is accompanied by headache and sometimes not. It's certainly plausible, and there are reported cases of people having cognitive deficit, and temporary loss of memory would fit with that. Other possibilities for this set of complaints would be a type of seizure disorder, and that could be identified possibly by a sleep-deprived EEG. The duration of the temporary loss of memory would be helpful to know exactly what that was like. This is certainly an individual where I would want a brain scan. I would want to be sure that the brain was structurally normal, there were no AVMs, and that this wasn't some sort of stroke equivalent. But given that it's been going for 20 years and it sounds like it's completely reversible, I would say probabilistically the first two things I mentioned are more likely going to be the diagnosis there. So I hope that's helpful. Very interesting question. One more story, kind of an interesting one. A study was just published in the Annals of Internal Medicine. And it's a study looking at people from Spain who participated in 2002 in a cleanup of a massive oil spill that occurred along the coast of northwestern Spain. The group that was the study population was a group of fishermen who worked along that coast. Half of them participated in the oil cleanup. The other half, for whatever reason, did not. And the cleanup workers had significant changes in their airways. They had elevated levels of 3 of 11 markers of airway injury, markers for oxidative stress, that is nitric oxide, vascular endothelial growth factor, and something called basic fibroblast growth factor. all of these were significantly higher among cleanup workers. And also, a bit scary, these workers had higher rates of structural chromosomal abnormalities in circulating white blood cells. So this suggests chromosome damage and persistent airway injury in those workers. Now, we had this oil spill off the coast of Florida last year, and we need to consider that this may, in fact, also be a public health issue for people who participated in that cleanup effort, which unfortunately was not marked by the best distribution of protective garments, for example, or masks. And here we have data, more data, that that's something that we need to have ready and available and transportable and distributed before we start messing around with aerosolizing hydrocarbons. Let's go to Susan in Monterey. Hello, Susan, and welcome to the program.
Good morning, Dr. Don.
Good morning.
I'm well, thank you. All my tests came back, I think I told you a couple of weeks ago, and nothing is wrong.
That's great.
Majorly wrong. Just some minor problems, I think, can be cured. I wanted to find out why the doctor had told me to have a colonoscopy.
Yes.
But I'm wondering if I still need to have it. I mean, just your opinion. I'll talk to him later. But I mean, since everything came out okay, and I'm feeling fine except for, you know, the joint problems in my knee, I just wondered if I still need to have it. And I wonder also, when you have a colonoscopy, I didn't talk to him yet, but do I have to go under anesthesia, because I can't do that?
Okay, well, let me start with the second question first. It is possible to do a colonoscopy on a completely conscious, unsedated patient, but it's uncomfortable. So in general, we try to do what's called conscious sedation, which uses drugs like Versed, which is a Valium relative. That's very different from general anesthesia, where you have intubation and halothane gas to render you unconscious and then other drugs to render you paralyzed. So I'm not sure what your level of anesthesia intolerance is, but most people can tolerate a little bit of intravenous Valium, and that isn't going to hurt them. We do recommend colonoscopy for screening. It's debatable. There are alternative ways of doing the screening, and everybody is still arguing about it because, remember, we're trying to find a disease that you may or may not have. So let me tell you about some alternatives. You could do fecal occult blood testing every year, three different specimens, and statistically over a 10-year period, one colonoscopy is about as good at finding colon cancer as annual fecal occult blood testing. Of course, if the fecal occult blood testing is positive, then you have to do a colonoscopy anyway to find the cancer or some other study. What other studies could you do? Something called a double contrast barium enema is a very good, not quite as good as colonoscopy, but a good screening device for colon cancer. You can do a flexible sigmoidoscopy that goes up the first half of the colon, the lower half, and doesn't need anesthesia. I do those all the time in the office, or used to do them. I don't do them as much anymore, but I used to do them all the time without anesthesia, and it isn't horribly uncomfortable for the patient because I'm a wimp. I don't like to hurt people. You can also combine that with a barium enema, and that has about the same rate of success over 10 years of finding colon cancer as a colonoscopy. And finally, there's virtual colonoscopy. And that might be one that you could talk to your doctor about. A virtual colonoscopy is done with a CT scanner. It's a lot of radiation dose, so you don't want to do it all the time. But you take the purgative and have the diarrhea, clean yourself out, and then you get contrast introduced into your rectum, and you drink some contrast, and then you have a CT scan, and you get a picture of the lining of the intestine, which is very accurate, in some hands as good as colonoscopy. It depends on the experience of the radiology reading it, but it is an alternative way of screening for colon cancer.
Well, I thank you for your information. I was just wondering if you'd say something about SAD. When the holidays come, I know I've heard that a lot of people have it, and I traced mine back, and I know it came from childhood. We had a home that during the Christmas there was a lot of stress and strife, and I guess that's where it started. And of course, to this day, I still have it. I've never quite been able to shake it. And but it's very real. And it's during the holidays. Sometimes I'm almost immobilized because I don't feel the same way about the holidays as a lot of people do.
Well, seasonal affective disorder is technically defined as a disease of depression and low energy, which occurs when the light changes and the photons get, well, basically, we have less light. It's coming in at a more oblique angle. And so we just don't get the stimulation to our retina. We don't get the release of melatonin from our pineal gland. And somehow that throws things off. Other people have hypothesized, and I think I heard this perhaps 5 or 10 years ago now, that it's related to vitamin D levels dropping in the wintertime. And some people do indeed appear to respond quite well to high-dose vitamin D. And so individuals, let's say, who have a level of 15, if you dose them with 5 or 10,000 units for a couple of months and get them up to a level of 45, reportedly have less SAD symptoms in the wintertime. So that's something for you to think about doing.
Well,
there's also the problem that you have associations that are psychological, that are negative with, you know, Santa. I live with a Grinch who is a wonderful guy, but he doesn't have good Christmas associations.
Yeah.
So for him, the Christmas carols and the Santa and all of this have a very ironic, uncomfortable, unpleasant sort of a set of associations. And for him, that's always an issue when I'm all happy and Christmassy, and it's just not his thing. So, you know, there's the psychological aspect of it as well as the physiologic aspect to be considered.
Yeah, well, I believe that's more my case because most of the time I'm pretty happy and pretty stable, but there was a lot of stress in our home growing up, and it was almost always surface around Christmas, you know, with the shopping and the stress and then the different interactions with certain family members, and it really was not a happy time. And over the years, I haven't been able to shake it, even though I have my own life and my own home now. It's still, there's something that just still remains within me that I have this little bit of a sense of dread at the holidays. But
well,
anyway, I thank you so
thank you very much for your
information.
All I can tell you is that you're not alone. I hope
thank
that helps
you.
A little bit.
It does. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Well, this is an interesting study published last month in the Journal of the American Medical Association. It was leveraged off of the Nurses' Health Study, which is 80,000 women answering questionnaires, and followed for over 20 years now. So you can go through and data mine that database for all kinds of associational things. This is yet one more, but it's an interesting one. It's about gout and the consumption of beverages sweetened with high fructose corn syrup. The study, again, with a denominator of 80,000 women, had just under 800 who developed gout. And after adjusting for all of the variables that we know affect your probability of gout, which would include age, body mass index, medical conditions such as diabetes or chronic renal disease, daily consumption of one fructose sweetened soft drink raised the risk of gout by about 74%, giving a relative risk of 1.74. And if you drank two or more soft drinks, the risk was 139%, that is to say, a relative risk of 2.39, or almost 2.5 times greater. This is compared to drinking one soft drink per month. Very important to discourage the consumption of these soft drinks in adults. We've been talking a lot in society over the last few months about taking care of that in children, but it's also extremely important to do it in adults. Another interesting study that was published in the last few months looked at dental treatment and the risk for stroke or MI. We've known that there's an inflammatory connection between heart attacks and strokes for a very, very long time. Even something like a pneumonia infection or anything that raises inflammatory mediators in the body tends to amp up the inflammation that's taking place in the plaque. And this plaque, which lines the inside of the arteries in the heart and also in the neck, is at best a physical blockage of blood flow and fairly harmless as long as it doesn't block 90% of the pipe. But when this plaque becomes activated, when it becomes inflamed, it softens and is subject to shear force so that as the blood washes across it, it can crack and open up a piece of collagen underlying the epithelium to the bloodstream. And immediately the platelets jump on that and try to form a clot across the entire vessel. It's a safety mechanism gone badly wrong. So when this happens, you get a heart attack or a stroke. This study looked at Medicaid. In this state, it would be Medi-Cal claims, because for people who have dental care coverage, at least in some states, and so the researchers could look at, has this person had one of the following dental services, deep cleaning, periodontal disease codes, and then look at whether or not there was a bump in their heart attacks or strokes in the subsequent months. And what they found was they had about 11,000 patients, and 41% had histories of coronary artery disease. Of these 11,000 patients, they found an association that was quite significant for hospitalization for an ischemic stroke or a myocardial infarction within the 4 weeks after undergoing an invasive dental procedure. So this would be like periodontal surgery or deep cleaning. And what they came out with a suggestion is that in circumstances where people with risk factors for heart disease are undergoing periodontal procedures, that even though it's going to make them bleed more in the short term, we should be putting individuals on low-dose aspirin for prophylaxis. This is a extrapolation from this data. I want to emphasize this study proving that aspirin will bring down the rate of MI and stroke has not been done in this subpopulation, but it seems a sensible thing to do, and I wanted to bring it to your attention. Very interesting little news of the weird that I wanted to share with you. This one is a bone marrow registry in New England that hired sexy, flirtatious female models, had them dress up in heels and short skirts and lab coats, and solicit people for DNA swabs of their mouth in the mall to create a bone marrow registry. So they went out and they elicited potential donors saying, "Hey, big boy, don't you want to be a hero? Come on, do this." After the people expressed interest, the models would hand them off to registry employees who would take mouth swabs. Well, so far, so good. But they also took insurance information and billed these people's insurance for charges up to $4,300 for the donor test. And it was just a scam, apparently. The test really shouldn't cost more than $100. I just am reminded of the girls who used to go out to the college campuses and give out free cigarettes. Be wary of beautiful girls in short skirts and high heels trying to sell you something. Let's go to Bruce in Elkhorn. Hello, Bruce, and welcome to the program.
Yes. Hi, Dr. Dunn. I want to mention there was a study that came out about 6 months ago where they were looking at MI and stroke and seeing that there was a doubling among the population that did not brush their teeth daily compared to those that did twice a day. There's a significant difference between people that brushed once a day and twice a day.
Right, and not to mention also flossing, and the data on Alzheimer's disease and dementia with gum disease is just astonishing. So
that underlying inflammation, mentioned going to the dentist, but you're probably more at risk if you just don't brush your teeth regularly.
Well, the point is, if you get to the point where you have periodontal disease, you're in deep trouble and you're already, you know, halfway down the hole, and we want to try to keep you from going deeper. But prevention, again, as I think is the theme of this program a lot, is prevention is way, way better than treatment.
Yes. Okay. Thank you for that. That was all I wanted to comment on.
Okay. You wanted to just emphasize that. Thank you very much
Sure.
for the call, Bruce.
Thanks.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Melanie in Santa Cruz.
Hi, Dr. Dawn. I have a question about aspirin and a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory. I understand there are these studies that are coming out showing low-dose aspirin is protective for various things.
All kinds of unexpected things, like prostate cancer metastasizing to the bone and colon cancer and, yes, all sorts of interesting things.
Now, I can't take aspirin because I'm on Nilumetone, Relafin is its brand name,
uh-huh,
for rheumatoid arthritis. But I'm wondering, do you know anything about the mechanisms of a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drug like that and aspirin? And is it possible that there might be some protective action from the Relafin?
Well, we have data looking at aspirin and ibuprofen. And
uh-huh,
what that shows is that compared to aspirin alone, aspirin plus ibuprofen is actually less protective. So the,
uh-huh,
so the ibuprofen kind of inhibits at least some of the benefit. And this was looking at stroke and heart attack only, not at these cancer studies, which I believe have a different mechanism, not purely an anti-inflammatory or an antiplatelet action, which is what we attribute the benefit of aspirin to, is its very potent and persistent antiplatelet effect. So we think,
yes,
that's why it works for heart disease and stroke. It works very rapidly, and it persists for several weeks. So if you are going to anticoagulate someone who's been taking regular aspirin, you like to get them off the aspirin for a while before you anticoagulate them, in fact, because you get such an amplification when you add a different anticoagulant mechanism. Getting back to the cancer effects, ibuprofen has been shown to be protective in colon cancer, but data about the prostate cancer, again, it's postulated to be a different mechanism, so you probably don't get that benefit. In your situation, you're right, you really have a contraindication, and even if you were to risk the complications of taking both aspirin and nalbutamone, you would be not getting the kind of benefit from the aspirin that you might otherwise get. Where I would go with that would be to consider using a combination of high-dose fish oil and maybe some vitamin E. But certainly the high-dose fish oil, and by high-dose I mean perhaps 200 milligrams of omega-3 fatty acid, there are some studies that compare that to aspirin and show that there is a commensurate benefit, and you would not have the contraindications gastrointestinally.
Yes.
So that might be a good compromise solution for you.
Yes, I am taking the fish oil 1,200 milligrams per day.
Yeah, I'd double up on that, and you'd probably get your aspirin benefit, at least for stroke and heart disease.
Okay, thank you for that suggestion.
You're welcome, and I want to encourage everyone to do what Melanie just did, which is think about combinations of drugs and make sure that you have been checked for drug interactions. Doctors try to do it, pharmacists try to do it, but everyone's overworked and has a billion things thrown at them. Don't assume that your doctor knows everything you're taking, and be sure that you look in the package inserts that you're given with your drugs for potential interactions and bring them to the attention of your doctor or your pharmacist. They may say, okay, it's a risk-benefit thing and you're better off taking that risk, but a professional opinion with a highlighted question is always a good idea. Thank you, Melanie, for modeling good behavior.
My pleasure, and thank you so much for the very generous gift you give us with your program.
My pleasure. Happy Christmas.
Thank you.
Let's go to Jan in Aptos. Hello, Jan.
Hi.
Hi.
I just want some clarification. If you're already taking low-dose aspirin, then if you have dental work done, like heavy cleaning, for instance, do you take more, or are you already protected? Or?
You are already protected.
Okay.
And we know this for sure. There's not an increased benefit to inhibiting the platelets more.
Okay. And also, a question unrelated to that, Achilles tendonitis. I have a huge bone spur, and I guess surgery is about the only thing that's really going to fix it. And my brother had a similar problem, and he said his went away.
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard of that.
Well, Achilles tendonitis is not a bone spur, so I'm not really quite sure what your actual problem is. You may have plantar fasciitis, which is more commonly associated with a bone spur. It's on the bottom of the heel.
Right.
And Achilles tendonitis is on the back of the heel, and
right,
it's in the tendon, not in the bone. Sometimes the tendon will actually scar up and develop calcium. So on an x-ray, it'll look like a heel spur. But this heel spur is on the back, not on the bottom of the heel.
That's where mine is.
Where?
On the back.
On the back. Okay.
Back of the heel.
So in
like
general,
a big hook.
Okay, but on the back, you're not standing on the hook when you stand up.
No.
Okay. So you have a calcific tendonitis of the Achilles tendon. that is a type of bone spur, but not the one I was thinking of. Your bone spur, the calcium won't go away, but the inflammation and irritation can go away. And mm-hmm. possibly your brother didn't have the calcium, or maybe he did, but his inflammation went away.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, the inflammation's not going away.
Mm-hmm. And you've done a physical therapy program with stretching, and you've yeah. had phonophoresis where they put steroid cream on and hit it with ultrasound, things like that.
Well, no, I haven't had that. I haven't even heard of that.
That's pretty standard.
I mean, I've had ultrasound on it.
Okay, good.
So I just didn't know about
the They probably did the creams.
Of the cream.
They probably
okay.
did the creams.
Okay, but, yes, I have had that.
Okay. Well, before you have surgery on the area, I would get at least two opinions from two different doctors, one of whom is not a surgeon.
Well, this is my podiatrist who's...
Well, yes, but that's a surgeon.
Yeah, yeah
so
okay.
get another opinion or two.
Okay, so who...
Maybe from a physiatrist, which is a rehab specialist. They know a lot about exercise and stretching.
Mm-hmm.
There may be something more that you can do with physical therapy than's been done.
Okay.
All
great.
Right.
Thanks so much.
Thanks very much.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Bill in Capitola. Hello, Bill, and welcome to the program.
Good morning. Hi.
Good morning.
I have a question. I have a 4-year-old niece who has eczema and has recently been diagnosed with a form of asthma, kind of involves a lot of coughing rather than...
Cough variant asthma, yes.
Right. And I understand that there's some connection between eczema and asthma. The eczema is much better than it was when she was an infant,
mm-hmm.
but it's still there and kind of...
Right. She's following the classic pattern for someone who has Th2 dominant person, and there's two types of lymph cells. There's the T helper 1 and the T helper 2, and the T helper 2s are the ones that, when they're overactive, you get allergies, you get eczema, you get food allergies, colic in infancy, and then you get eczema in infancy, and then later on you start developing reactions to environmental antigens such as cat, dander, and dust mites. And the whole thing is now thought to be, if not primary, at least secondarily associated with too many antibiotics in childhood and not enough bacteria. Children who grow up on farms exposed to barnyard animals have a lot less allergies. She's probably in a very clean home.
No, she's not.
She's not? Okay.
She's with dogs and cats. Well, has been since birth.
Okay. But but anyway, to get back to your question, what is your question?
Well, the question is, she's currently, what seems to work is, I think it's Zyrtec. She's been taking that, and that sort of has worked on the cough and the eczemas with fairly frequent doses of the prescription strength, 2.5%, I think it is, cortisone, or the whatever the 2.5 cortisone is. And if that is kind of what we're faced with, or if there's something more, maybe...
Well, I definitely have a suggestion in coming from alternative land, but with, I think, very, very good research to back it up. That's the addition of certain probiotic bacteria. There are Lactobacillus rhamnosus, sometimes also referred to as Lactobacillus GG, has been shown even as a purified strain, which is probably not the best way to do probiotics, but is the, quote, most scientific way to do it, unquote, has been shown to reduce incidences of both eczema and asthma. And we think the mechanism of this is that the bacteria themselves, when they colonize the intestine, actually teach the body not to overreact to these trivial, non-dangerous proteins.
And how do you get that then?
It's taken orally, and you can purchase supplements for children. The research that I recall used 16 billion colony-forming units per day of the Lactobacillus rhamnosus, and you can find lots of good probiotic products. I would recommend a company called Claire Labs with a K. I believe it's carried by the local compounding pharmacy over on 41st, which is Loudoun. I don't remember where you live. Where are you?
Yeah, Capitol.
Okay, so that's right in your neighborhood. And they do carry Claire Lab products, and they probably carry the pediatric one because there's quite a lot of call for that. I am a great believer in the use of probiotics in children. I've seen it work beautifully for colic, and there's data for that. I've seen it work for asthma and eczema, and whenever I see a case of those things, I always recommend that to the parents, because all you're doing is setting up an environment in that child's intestine, which is what it should have anyway. Mm-hmm. So you haven't really changed anything, and it's not a drug, and you aren't going to get the physiological pushback that you would get from a drug. I don't like using steroids in small children, because a small amount of that does get into the bloodstream, and I presume she's using it topically and not or inhaled and not orally.
Yeah, topically.
Yeah. So a certain amount does get in, not that much, but still, in children, we know that the law of small doses is operative. On the other hand, I don't want the child to be miserable, and I certainly don't want her to have an asthma attack.
Right. Well, we'll definitely
Get her some probiotics. Talk to mom about it. The literature's there. And in fact, if you want more, if you go to the archives of AskDrDawn.com, there is a archived interview with Gary Huffnagel, great name, H-U-F-F, Nagel, and it's all about probiotics, and he talks about this research.
Okay.
All right. Very good.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Let's go to Sean in Pacific Grove. Hello, Sean, and welcome to the program.
Oh, hi.
Hi.
I have actually a couple questions about two different members of my family. One, my wife is trying something called oil pulling, which is an Ayurvedic thing. Basically, you put a tablespoon of oil in your mouth and you pull it through your teeth like once a day for about 10 to 15 minutes. Have you ever heard of that? I just wondered if you had any input for that.
Okay. Well, I'm not sure how powerful that would be. It seems kind of drop in a bucketish to me, but I can understand the concept. The Ayurvedic form of medicine, which comes from India, has a lot of detoxification techniques. Toxins come in two varieties, the type that are water soluble, that can be lost through the urine, and the type that are oil soluble that tend to stay in the body. Like, for example, heavy metals will deposit in body fat, and DDT and dioxin and PCBs and BPA and all of these other things are lipid soluble, and certainly our environment is full of them. So we all carry around blood levels, but also much higher fat levels. So the concept is that if you have fat in a place in the body where there is a permeable membrane, that you can pull some of these substances out of blood circulation, and when you spit out that oil after the 15 minutes, that a certain amount of environmental pollutants and the estrogenic compounds that are in plastics will have soaked into that oil, and so you'll be getting it out of your body.
Right.
Another technique that they do that I think is probably a great deal more, let's just say I think it probably works a lot better, is they do oil enemas, but that's obviously gross and has consumer acceptability issues. Yeah, you've got a much huger surface area, and you probably get more transfer of compounds out that way. I have never seen any research. I've never seen anybody like do a study. I could tell you how to do a study. You inject something harmless that's oil soluble into the bloodstream, get a blood level, do this oil pull thing, and then check a blood level, you know, 15, 20 minutes afterwards and see if you've affected the blood level. You might be able to validate the technique by some sort of method like that. But as far as I know, no one's ever done it. So I would say harmless, might help, won't hurt, would be my take on it.
Okay, yeah, I was just curious about, you know, whether, yeah, exactly, was it having much of an effect? And yeah, they say that there's a healing crisis that can happen with it, so I'm kind of looking for that to see if she's, you know, having any results from it or whatever. But I was just wondering what your take on that was. The other question I had involves my son, who has, like your previous call with Bill there, he has a rash that comes on kind of like poison oak, but no exposure to poison oak. Mm-hmm. And it seems like he rashes up with anything. Could be exposure to too much heat. It could be exposure
Where's the rash? Because we're low on time. So where is the rash?
Anywhere on his body.
Anywhere.
It could be on his legs. It could be on his back. A lot of times it's in hot spots, but mm-hmm. not always.
How old is your son?
Sometimes it's on his face.
How old is your son?
He's 13.
Okay. Yeah. Take him off dairy, soy, and wheat. Good luck. But at least try eliminating soy.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
That shouldn't be too hard. Do it for like a month and see if it makes a difference. It sounds like a food sensitivity. It's a guess which one it is. There are blood tests for that. So at some point in the future, you could certainly go to an alternative medicine doctor and get the blood testing done, see if he does have a lot of sensitivities. But it sounds like a food-related reaction. Getting him off of preservatives and junk food might help a lot, too.
Yeah, we've already done that.
Okay.
But yeah, the wheat, we tried a little bit, but it's kind of hard to
Wheat's,
do that.
Wheat's
yeah.
very hard.
But, so you suspect soy as being one of the higher ones?
I would do that one because you can do it, and it's likely. And
yeah.
it's a lot easier than wheat. Good luck. I got to go.
Thank you, Dr. Don.
Thank you. You've been listening to Ask Dr. Don. This is Dr. Don saying so long and stay healthy.